And that picture has completely changed, where to me, really, it doesn't matter anymore how many. It's more what you do, what you accomplish with your team, and how. You can accomplish the same things with two people, and you can accomplish the same things or even less with more people.
If you want to get stuff done, then you have come to the right place. This is the Get Stuff Done podcast, brought to you in association with RDI Worldwide, a weekly interview series with prominent and diverse people from around the world who will share their own unique insights on what it takes to get stuff done and their personal strategies for doing so. My name is Gordon Dudley, the creator of the Get Stuff Done project and host of this podcast. Thank you so much for being with us. We hope you enjoy this episode and would love to hear your feedback anytime. Let's get stuff done.
Welcome to the Get Stuff Done podcast. Today I'm joined by Sunmi Che, aka Sunny, who is the current VP of Global Business Development at Plus. She is a Korean German based in Munich, but who has worked in Korea, in China, in America, and now also Germany. So I am really looking forward to chatting with her today. She has spent a considerable amount of her career at Bosch, where she was working in a few different business units. And from her education, she obtained her undergraduate degree at the Berlin School of Economics and Law, and her master's in business administration, MBA, at Yonsei in Seoul. So I think that given her very unique background and international experience, and I think she has plenty to say about getting stuff done, which is why I wanted to have her as a guest today. Sunny, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you, Gordon, for the very kind introduction. I'm super excited to be part of this Getting Stuff Done podcast. When you first told me about what it is to basically bring thought leaders together with different backgrounds from different industries, I thought this is a very, very cool opportunity to talk to you and just share, you know, perspectives, experiences. So excited for your questions to come.
Excellent. Excellent. So first of all, I'm going to jump right into it, Sunny. Tell us a little bit about what Plus does and what you do in your role right now.
Sure. Happy to do that. So Plus, it was former Plus AI, is a Silicon Valley-based technology company focused on developing software for autonomous driving. So we developed the software to basically build the virtual driver of vehicles. And here we differentiate by fully autonomous, which I think a lot of people know or connect to autonomous, where you basically complement or replace the driver in the future with a virtual driver. And at the same time, our software also powers supervised autonomy for levels of level two plus, meaning a driver in autonomous product or more an advanced AI-based driver assist system. So we operate, so the headquarter is in Santa Clara, but basically how I onboarded Plus was roughly 2.5 years ago, when they decided to expand the footprint into Europe because of a partnership with an OEM, with a European OEM. So my role was to establish the European footprint for Plus in Europe.
And is Plus only focused on commercial vehicles or also passenger vehicles as well?
That's a great question. And I see you did your homework and read a little bit about Plus. We initially started with a focus on heavy duty trucks. You're right, commercial vehicles, because at that time when we talked about complete driverless autonomous use cases, we thought that this is going to be the first use case. Basically, there is a big pain point already today having driver shortage. And also there is a lot of accidents happening on long highway, long haul trips. And that's where we really saw a pain point that this technology can solve and also a faster deployment. So this was the initial focus. Nevertheless, over the last months, I would say we also realized that actually the technology, because we talk about the software, can also apply to different vehicle types. And actually, this is the very good question fitting to the kind of strategic timing that we're currently exploring, is also to see if our technology can be deployed on other vehicle types, such as light commercial vehicles or even passenger vehicles can be deployed. So yes, we are actually looking at the wider mobility market and do not necessarily say this only specific vehicle type. We talk about enabling or empowering the whole mobility with our software on different levels of autonomy.
Got it. And in your role, it's a global role. How many different time zones or regions are you covering, and how do you practically cover that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So it covers basically global, like the title says, and sometimes it is calls where you have basically three different time zones on the call. It's mainly US, Europe, and Asia Pacific or Oceania. We do also have operations in Australia, where we announced also a partnership with one of the world's leading infrastructure providers based out of Australia. So for those calls, it can get tough for one or two parties. So for one party, it's either super late. Sometimes for me, it's super early. So we kind of rotate. But it's challenging, but it's also a beautiful thing to work globally across different continents, because that's when you really, really bring different competencies together. And I think also really in partnerships, right? You make such complex technologies happen in a successful way. Mm.
And I know, in the scheduling of this interview, you were traveling. Do you find yourself traveling in person a lot? Is that something that's a frequent part of your work?
Absolutely, it is, because my role is essentially developing business, developing partnerships, and understanding how we can partner across the entire automotive ecosystem. So that means I need to meet people, right? I need to understand what the companies do, who are the people behind, how do the company's core competencies, but also the people and the teams, the DNA, how do they match together so that we can really create something together that brings value to the entire industry? So it's a very, very customer and external facing position, where this is also the part that I actually really enjoy, the part of meeting people, developing relationships out of that developing business. And traveling is definitely a pretty big part of it, because I frequently travel to the US because that's where our headquarters sits. But of course, I also meet frequent customers in the US across entire Europe. So it's even within Europe, I'm traveling quite a bit, as well as Asia, where I'm also traveling back and forth. So it's a travel intense job, but at the same time, I'm also very thankful, because I feel by traveling and meeting different people from different cultures, you really, really learn a lot and grow as well.
What do you find is the most challenging thing about doing business across borders?
That's a multiple question, I think. So I would kind of divide it into on a professional level, right, and how is it maybe also challenging from a personal perspective?
Sure.
I would say from a professional level, it's really adjusting to the country's culture and adapting how you conduct the conversation, how you negotiate, how you approach the relationship. So if I compare really, for example, US and Korea, for example, it's a very, very different sort of way how to do business. And you probably can relate as well, because you've been living in Korea actually longer than I have. But it's a very, US is more transaction based, get things quickly done. So there is a very, very high pace, high level of expectation to get things done fast. In Korea, it's not necessarily different to get things done fast. But in order to get there, to really create a result, you need to spend a lot of time in the beginning to build the relationship and to gain the trust. They're not going to give you something right away just because you have the best technology. So it's a little bit more complex there, I think. And then there it requires a lot of understanding. It requires patience, but it also requires, in my concrete situation, kind of translating how business is done in Korea or how business is done in Europe to the US team that is essentially joining all the meetings, right? And they haven't been to all these countries, they haven't worked with the different types of companies. So it's really building the bridge across continents, but also across different company DNAs. I would say those are probably the core challenges. And then on a personal level, I think it comes with it. It's difficult to kind of really settle in one place because you're kind of all over. On the one hand, I really enjoy it. On the other hand, it makes it challenging to stabilize sort of your life where you actually have your place, where you have your partner. And I think the challenge is finding the balance of getting things done on the professional side, getting those deals, getting those partnerships. On the other hand, also making sure you get things done in your personal life, such as maintaining a healthy relationship, maintaining your personal health and also mental health. So that's, you know, a challenge that I'm constantly trying to work on. And I would say that's an ongoing sort of journey. But yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting challenge to solve.
What's your personal strategy or special technique for keeping your mental health? What's the thing that you do on a regular basis in that way?
Yeah, I used to be better at doing things on a regular basis, but normally what I need for my mental health is really getting out in the nature, because you spend so much screen time on doing virtual calls with different countries, or you spend a lot of time on the computer itself, just emails, presentations and whatnot. So because we're in such a connected world and it's getting more and more connected, it's sometimes really hard to switch off from devices, from the internet, from all the buzz that's going on worldwide, that sometimes feels a little bit overwhelming, not just the professional side, but all the information that you get. So sometimes for me, a way to get kind of mental health is just to get out in the nature, into the mountains, and also don't look or use the phone, right? And just focus on the moment, focus on the person that you're with, and kind of really indulge in nature. And that really helps me. That's one. And the second one is also just like a physical workout, just kind of letting all my energy out, running. I ran 2 marathons. I haven't done one last year. This is like a goal for this year for me to get back into it. But when I'm running and I'm like physically active, that really helps me to release a lot of the stress or, you know, anxious emotions that I may have. And then I'm just really focused on getting things done, in the sense, getting to the goal, yeah, getting to the finish line, and just being physically worn out. And then I feel really, really positive and energetic after.
I want to ask about your marathons. Were you very diligent in doing a kind of 12 or 18 week preparation plan building up to the training, or did you just rely on underlying strength and fitness and just do it?
It was a mix of both. Okay. And the first one was very structured, and I had a training crew that helped me to prepare very systematically on a 10-week basis. Okay. And that was really good because I really built up a core strength. The second year, when I started my first year at Plus, actually I transitioned from Bosch to Plus. So the first year was a lot going on, building up the entity. So, and it was just me, right? I was the first and only person in Europe. So I didn't find the routine of having that systematic training. So I just kind of went into the second marathon not thoroughly training. And that was definitely a lesson learned, when you see the difference of a systematic routine training versus just getting into something. And I definitely paid for it in terms of very, very bad pain. And I made it to the finish line. I think there's still a way to get to the goal, but it's a way of, do you do it in a sustainable way, or do you do it in a very painful way? And I think that was actually a really good experience, because physically I could really feel, okay, I'm not going to do that again. And you learn, right? And next time when I do a marathon, I will definitely not go into it untrained. Okay. That's for sure.
Okay. I'm always really fascinated with global organizations and their culture and how they operate in countries overseas. So for mm-hmm. you, you've worked for Bosch in Germany and also Korea?
Correct.
And you've worked for an American company in Germany?
Correct.
Who are you working for in Shanghai?
Also Bosch.
Also a
So
German company.
maybe to summarize, I was overall 10 years at Bosch and then started the 2 or 3 years in Stuttgart in the headquarters. So that was like Germany. Very, very German, I would say. Then I relocated to, and then throughout this phase, I had a short relocation to Bosch Korea for 6 months. That was really exciting as a Korean person or Korean German person to have that combination. And then after that, I was relocated to Shanghai for 3.5 years, where I was working for the board member who was responsible for entire Asia Pacific. So throughout that time, I traveled across all Asian countries, I would say, on a regular basis. And then from Shanghai, I was directly relocated to San Francisco, where I worked really focused on all the tech startups in the space of, connected, electrified, and also automated autonomous mobility. So that there I experienced working for a German company in the US, you're right. I worked with a lot of tech startups, which was a very new experience for me. And then in that context, I towards the end of my Bosch phase, I came across Plus, which is an autonomous driving technology startup. So I met them. I thought the mission of really transforming the way how you move people and goods in a safe and also sustainable way really, really inspired me. And what also inspired me is the very different working environment, different DNA, different way, definitely how to get things done. And then I took the courage to kind of leave my safety net and say, okay, it's been a great journey. It's been a really, really good company and still is. But then I thought it was an intentional decision. I need to get out of my comfort zone. If I don't do it now, I'll probably be in this company forever or like in a big company type that I feel comfortable in. But I wanted to challenge myself to throw myself into a very new environment, right? Where I have zero network, I have no idea how they work. I just know what they do. I know the people, and based on that, I just kind of went for it. And then I think the additional challenge was to not start with Plus in the US, but basically on week one, I was back in Europe where there was no footprint. So without really knowing the people, I had to build a relationship with them on a remote level, and also expand the footprint in Europe without really knowing the operations and people very well. So it was kind of being thrown into the cold water, but it was, or it has been and still is, a very, very exciting journey and also of personal growth, I'd say.
Fantastic. That's great to hear. And so leading on from that question about the origin of the company, so do you feel that as so German is your first language, right?
Yes,
So
correct.
do you feel that when you were working for Bosch overseas, being German, was that a real significant advantage? Do you feel that the German culture was still very present in the Bosch operations in the different countries, or was it more localized, simply having a kind of German headquarters with some Germans?
Certain things were localized, but at the same time, I think having the German background, speaking in language, and also understanding how the headquarter operates, how they take decisions, and that part I learned a lot in Shanghai when I was working with the German board member and then working with all the other board members, right? Understanding how decisions are taken on a group level. And how sort of German people in headquarters who may never have been exposed to the outside world, how they think and what their concerns are, understanding that helped me to get things done in my role in the US. Because I can bring in the most interesting tech startups, but if I don't know how I need to present this startup to the headquarters, then I can be convinced, but in the end, I still need to convince internally, right? Because most of such decisions are still being made in the headquarter business units. So that maybe answers your questions. Certain things are localized, but when it comes to really big investments or partnerships that have a global impact, then you cannot get around also convincing the German stakeholders. And for that, my experience is understanding both worlds again, here, US and Germany, has been very effective. I think in some cases, if I hadn't had that background, it would have been much more difficult to convince certain parties of the vision or the things we want to do.
Right. So it seems like you're very adept at what I think the proper word for is code switching. That is language plus culture plus, you know, the mix of the two. Tell me about the other languages that you speak. I mean, obviously, I can see and hear that you're speaking English, and we know that your first language is German. Tell us about the other languages that you can also speak.
German is my first language. But actually, my very first language was Korean, because both of my parents are Korean.
Okay.
Who emigrated to Germany sometime in the 70s. So their German is limited. So when they raised me, it was all in Korean.
Before but then school,
very young kind of. On, before school or kindergarten. Yeah, yeah. But then as soon as I went to kindergarten, you know, you're much more exposed to German kindergartners, children. So my German picked up, and that's why I would say today it's my first language. Okay. So I still maintain my Korean language, which is also very important to me. Not only on a professional level, but more so on the personal level. So my strongest languages, I would say, are German, English, and Korean. Okay. But then because of my kind of German school education, I learned French and Spanish during school. And then I spent 3.5 years in Shanghai. So I learned basic Chinese. I'm not saying I'm fluent, but I can have some easy basic conversation in Chinese because I had to in order for me to also get around. And then I also speak a little bit of Italian, which is kind of very close to Spanish. And I, spend quite some time in an Italian environment as well. So yeah, I think that sums it up.
So that is that totally seven languages at conversational level or above.
Yes.
Fantastic.
Correct.
That's
correct.
Fantastic. And I always remember the first time that I had a dream in German. And I realized, hang on, am I, you know, is my mind now changing? What I'm curious, what language do you usually dream in? Did you catch the question?
The last one, unfortunately, you were with the dreaming. You were gone.
I was saying how that I remember the first time that I had a dream in German, and I was thinking, gosh, is my brain kind of changing now? So I'm curious, what language do you usually dream in?
That's a really good question. I sometimes wonder myself because I don't always remember, but I think the main languages, and it switches, it's not just one. It is sometimes English, because I also speak English a lot, even though I live in Germany. So in my daily life, I actually speak probably more English than German, because my partner is more English speaking. And also in my office in Germany, everyone comes from a different country. So our working language is English as well. So English and German, probably, I would say. And then in different dream contexts, it can be Korean, but that's rather seldom, I would say, these days.
Okay, interesting. And how important would you say that languages has been in furthering your own professional career?
It's a subtle but powerful impact. It's not that you get a job or you get a deal because you speak that language. Not only because of that, you still have to have good technology or product or, you know, good commercial terms. But in order to develop such relationships and also conducting sometimes negotiations, getting relevant information between the lines, being able to speak Korean, for example, has been very, very helpful. Because sometimes you have different native speakers or native Korean speakers who have different English levels, right? So if you show that you can speak English, you can speak Korean, it's a different level of trust that you have. And it gets also more personal. So it accelerates a little bit the trust relationship, where you can actually build upon building that business relationship. And I think the same is also for German and English, right? If I talk to German automotive suppliers, if I can conduct this conversation completely in German, cracking German jokes, I mean, that even on a more natural level than in Korean, then it's definitely helpful.
For sure.
Yeah. So language and cultural understanding, sometimes I feel in business contexts or even when hiring people, that sometimes gets a little bit underestimated as a, oh, that's just a soft skill. And you look more into what background do people have? Where did they graduate? Or what have they done? And not so much who they are, and who they are is defined more by what you have experienced, right? And what level of cultural confidences you have, for example.
For sure. For sure. I mean, I defer to Simon Sinek on this, who says that the soft mm-hmm. skills are not soft. They're actually pretty, they're pretty hard and yes. pretty tough, and can be sometimes for some people the most daunting of mm-hmm. the things to do. So, and of course, there's a wide range of them as well. In terms of your kind of cultural background, you know, mm-hmm. I think talking in 2024, the awareness of Korea, the notoriety of so many Korean things in all the different cultural avenues is infinitely more prevalent than it was when you right. were growing up. How did the absence of any knowledge about your background of Korea, how did that impact you when you were growing up?
That's a good question. I think when you're younger, you don't really think so much about it, of what that means to have a Korean or German, because you don't really know much more. Of course, I used to travel back and forth, but your conscious about what that means is not as developed. So when I was growing up, I didn't feel so much of that impact, I would say, but I felt it more and more as I was kind of maturing and in my thinking and my awareness. And I think especially when I started my professional career, I kind of started to learn what potential disadvantage might it have compared to maybe people who have like a full German background, or, you know, have that network, let's say. And at the same time, what advantages do I have because of my Korean background, cultural understanding, language, and so on. So that's where you develop this self-awareness of being aware where it could be a disadvantage and kind of like accepting it also and working with it, but then more focusing on how can I use this as a tool, as a benefit, and as a strength. Right. And to really focus on that and not seeing it as a disadvantage or as a weakness at all. But that took time to figure that out.
That's a very good way of looking
and
at
I think the journey for me to do my times. MBA in Korea was not necessarily to just get my educational, title or the academic goal. It was also to really find that out, which is why I intentionally decided to do my MBA in Korea and not in the US, where it may be more renowned. I wanted to spend the time there, right, and figure out what is my Korean DNA really, and to develop this and strengthen that, and then come back to Germany and figure out, right, like how can I use it as an advantage, and what does it also mean for me. So I think that came over, that kind of understanding came when I was early 20s. Before that, I didn't really think much about it, honestly.
Okay. Okay, and now the where Korea is in terms of its soft power, its cultural prominence, now really leading the world in many areas. Do you see increasing benefits from that? Is that something that you can feel kind of tangibly, or does it not make so much difference?
I would say in my personal life, I can totally feel the hype and the change, how Korean culture is being perceived. And then that's really exciting to see how the cultural elements are now really being globalized and have a global reach on a professional level. I mean, like, for example, the K-pop wave does not impact any of the business conversations. It not in a hard, direct way, but indirect way, yes, because it's always a good kind of, you know, icebreaker, yeah. You can talk about Korean culture. Oh yeah, I love kimchi or something. Or I like Korean barbecue. That's like always a good thing that at least you have now more business partners who are aware or who have been to Korea, right? So it's a good connection point. And also the perception that, for example, Korea has really, really leading innovative technology. And then when it comes to tech, that you have those big companies, whether it's LG, Samsung, SK Telecom, and so on, Hyundai Motor, of course, it's now really a global brand, which is recognized not for its products only, but also for the level of innovation. And I think that is pretty powerful for Korea. And I hope that this global business will even more so increase.
Yeah, I hope so too. And, you know, I think that we've just had the national elections, of course, in Korea, which will mean, even though economic mm-hmm. conditions might be a little bit weak, that there will now be a movement, right? We're going to be moving out of the wait and see status and mm-hmm. moving into a new era, whatever that new framework or status might be. There will be activity, and so I think that's definitely mm-hmm. definitely a good thing. I want to talk now a little bit about leadership. When did you move into your first leadership role?
I would say with my last position in the US with Bosch, even though we were a much, much smaller team by design, because our team was just developed, first time actually in the whole Bosch history where a headquarter for a new team is not in Germany, but in Silicon Valley in San Francisco, basically with the direction, be closer to the customer, right? And when we talk about autonomous, electrified, you know, the top-notch innovation does come a lot of the leading companies, whether we talk about Tesla or Uber, they're the ones who revolutionized sort of the space of electrified vehicles or shared mobility. So there we were a small team, but very, let's say, experienced, high-level people who used to run an organization of 60,000, 70,000, but now it was a very dense team of 10, 11 worldwide. And we had a footprint in Shanghai covering China and wider Asia Pacific, Germany for Europe, and then San Francisco / Sunnyvale, that's where the Bosch R&D facility is, was sort of covering the Americas. So in that context, I was globally heading the business development team, and initially started just by being me, because we first needed to figure out, you know, how do we want to set up this business? What is the business? It was a lot of strategy the first year, and then we identified customers and then also the need for growing the team. And then I started hiring a business development manager in the US. Then I had a business development manager in Germany, sort of covering Europe. And then one base out of Shanghai who would cover the Chinese market. So it was still a smaller team. And I would say in my current position, it's a very similar setup. And so that's when I really grew into also leading a team into a leadership position. And especially, I think, in my current leadership position at Plus, which is a startup and not a big corporate company with a legacy, I really learned what leadership means and how to lead in a different environment, big company versus small company, and also how to define leadership, right? And I think when I was younger and growing into my professional career, my desire was big. I want to lead many people. I want to lead a big department with like 100 people under me. And that's how I defined the relevance and importance and seniority of leadership. And that picture has completely changed, where to me, really, it doesn't matter anymore how many. It's more what you do, what you accomplish with your team, and how. You can accomplish the same things with two people, and you can accomplish the same things or even less with more people. So that's where I've really changed my perspective quite a bit, where, let's say, necessarily the title accomplishment or how many people you have led is not so prevalent for me anymore. So I think that's a positive change for me, because it changed my perspective, and it feels to me more suitable for what my DNA is and what also is important to me.
Yeah, I think that realization is a very meaningful one. Especially, I think what you stuck out to me was you said you can sometimes achieve even less with more people. That is so true.
Yeah.
And so I think it's clear that you are very good at getting stuff done yourself. You're a go-getter. You've already achieved a lot in your career. How do you ensure that your team members, the ones that you are leading, that they get everything accomplished that they should?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it took me some time to figure this out myself as well. But my learning is that it's really important to have a clear understanding of what the expectations and the goals are. What do we need to accomplish as a team? And if we break this down, what do I make it your responsibility? Making the team members accountable, making them understand that they are accountable for it, whether they can do it themselves, whether I say, this is what we need to accomplish, get it done. And I'm not asking you to know everything yourself, how to get it done, but I do expect you to find ways to get all the necessary resources for you to get it done. That means being creative, asking for help, communicating if you're stuck, and getting help from others across different functions. And I kind of give that as a general advice, because I think if you want to be successful and effective, especially in a startup, you sometimes get tasks where you don't know how to solve it, but you have to solve it. And to break a little bit the stigma, you only do what you're used to, or what you're assigned to do. No, you got to think left and right, and you got to think creative on how to find ways to get things done or solve problems, right? And I also always make clear, kind of making myself vulnerable, I don't know how to get all of this done. But let us figure out what we need to get it done and where we can get the missing pieces and puzzles, and let's work on this together. I think, so to summarize, one is clear expectation management and communication, what needs to get done. Second, showing that there are different paths of getting those things done and not being afraid for asking help, but also communicating if you're stuck to your manager or to your people around. And then I think the third one is making sure that the team members feel you are part of that getting things done. You're not leaving them alone. And if there is any issue, that they can come to you, right? And that you are there to kind of help, kind of get rid of the barriers, or helping them solve those things where they cannot, and that they have trust that you can they can talk to me about anything and ask for help. I think that's the key. And of course, on a day-to-day thing, it's just checking in with them as well, asking them how they are doing. Are you happy? Sometimes I just, are you happy in your life, in your role, in this journey, in this company? Like, let's talk about those things. And then also splitting it to, okay, on those tasks that we need to do, right, how are you doing on those? So I think having also this mental check-in that they feel you care of them, I think makes them perform even better.
That is the most comprehensive answer that I've ever got to that question. So if this was a traditional production, we would be having a round of applause coming through now. That's really fantastic.
Thank you.
No, thanks for providing that. Unfortunately, one of the things that Korea is also quite heavily known for is the glass ceiling, right? It is consistently, has been, by the Economist ranking, the bottom of the glass ceiling, even also than Japan, its neighbor country. And last month we had, of course, International Women's Day. You know, I wish I want to celebrate that, but I also wish that there wouldn't be a need to have to have that, right? I mean, I think with labels, it always becomes, female founder, is often that's made explicit when it shouldn't have to be, right?
You're right.
You spent a lot of your career in automotive industry. typically and traditionally very male-dominated. Silicon Valley, alt tech also
Right.
is quite heavily in that way. And Korea, of course, you also have experience working in Korea. How have you navigated the journey of being a female leader, to use the terminology, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this is a complex one, right? The role of female in sort of tech leaderships, but at the same time, it's also not complex at all. I think sometimes what makes it seem complex is how society and the industry talks about it. Like you said, sometimes I think the appreciation is good and making it a topic that, you know, we need to grow more female leaders and give also the chance, if all being equal, I'm not talking about quotas, for example. So I think the appreciation, encouragement, hey, do it. Yeah, there are opportunities, right? Be courageous. I think that's good and sort of creating a network where you empower each other. On the other hand, if you overdo it and like you said, you make it like such a big thing if it's a female and you highlight just the female part of it, then you actually can create the counter effect by losing the focus on the capability of that person. And then it's all about just, oh, she's female. So I think that is not really productive. I think it needs to be really a balanced story, highlighting, yes, it is exciting to have a female taking on that position, but the reason why that person is in that role is because she has this and this and that experience and competence and is performing and is a great leader. I think it has to be a two pillar side of the story. And sometimes I think it's too much on the gender topic. And for me personally, I never really wanted to make it a topic, or never wanted to be specifically on a diversity poster where sometimes you get asked, hey, there is a photo shoot, you know, and then you get asked because you have a German background but an Asian face. And on the one hand, sometimes I feel complimented that I get asked, but sometimes I also said, I don't want to make it a priority taking time to do that. Because I need to feel that me being on that poster actually does make a difference. But if it's just for the sake of a diversity campaign, then I don't really, it's not I don't want to support it. I think it's still, the messaging is still important, but I feel like you can have more impact by actually, you know, being part of a network or speaking at conferences and speaking to female other leaders or people who want to grow into a leadership role, rather than doing like a poster campaign, for example. I'm not saying posters are bad, it just needs to be a mix of all. And where in big companies especially, young female leaders really do see you actually have female leaders on president level, on executive level, on board member level, and not just on, oh, someone got promoted to a direct level. I mean, that's great, but I think it has impact if a company decides to put a female on a board member level, for example.
Yeah, I from asking similar questions to other female leaders, both within this podcast and over the last years running RTI, I've often found that some of the most successful female executives that I've spoken to and leaders are the ones who in their own mind don't see the barriers. They just took things as they were, and they went and did what they had to do.
Correct.
And I guess obviously that has been the way in which they have been able to achieve what they have. But at the same time, also, I wonder whether that is a very unique and specific type of ability to be able to do that, to overcome, where the majority get some kind of barrier, visible or invisible, and that's the end of it for them. They give up to pursue that. What do
You're absolutely right. I think that perspective and that perception is true. So it's sometimes easy to say for the female leaders who are in those positions, how to get there, because maybe they have that level of confidence, experience, how to deal with those sometimes gender-specific perceived discrepancies, right? And you're right, there's maybe the type that kind of feels impacted by that and maybe loses the courage to just move forward. And then there's a type, well, I just go in there. I don't care if I'm female or male. It's about what needs to get done and having that mindset. But then you can't expect everyone to have that mindset, right?
Exactly.
So there are differences. And maybe that's why there is maybe tendency even just less, because sometimes I do feel that male just go for it and they can sell themselves much stronger. And I do feel even sometimes with myself that I am more honest or maybe underestimate or don't want to be like too overselling, and also sometimes need to push myself. No, maybe I should sell myself stronger and not be always so humble and modest. That's, for example, a feedback that I have received multiple times that I want to improve on. And I think that's something that I want to also encourage female leaders or growing leaders to do, to not be afraid to sell what you're capable of and not to be too modest, right? Because I think in the outside world, that's not what's happening. You gotta be competitive. You gotta be strong and confident, and also not be afraid of expressing that. There's no shame to really promote and sell what you're capable of. And that, I think this is something for myself I want to improve, but I think this can also help a lot of other female colleagues that I've talked to. When I do like a mock interview, I'm like, it was good, but you can sell yourself much stronger.
Right. Right. And I think you highlighted a key difference. It's not bad to be confident about presenting the best version of you. Sometimes, you know, maybe personally feeling that it is too much or it is exaggerating. Regardless of that, the people that do are the ones that are getting the callback on the interview, mm-hmm. getting hired, getting mm-hmm. the promotion. And so in that context, we're not able to change that environment. That is what it is. And that's
right.
From male and female people making those decisions as well, right? The person who puts their hand up and steps forward is the one that gets it. But I guess also the other side of it is the presence of role models. And I think if mm-hmm. you know, if you can't see anyone who is remotely like you, that is for sure going to create some of, you know, almost holding yourself back is going to be the natural reaction, I think.
Mm-hmm. I think so too. And that's why I think what's most important in leading or doing what you do is really to be very authentic in who you are. And in order to be authentic, you gotta know yourself. You gotta know your own values, your own boundaries, what's not okay. And you gotta be very aware of who you are. And I think once you have reached that core, you can basically do anything, because then you don't live up to what other people expect from you, but you do things the way you think is right and that you're good at. And if companies see that as a value, you will naturally move up and people see that as a value. But if you try to navigate what other males, what other females are doing and try to live up to that expectation, and that's maybe not you, I don't think that brings you to success. And in a corporate matrix, maybe yes, but that's the question. Is that what you define as successful leadership, right? Is that what you want to do? And I think that's really up to everyone to decide. But I think for myself, like over the last years, it's really, what do I love to do? Where am I good at? How can I have impact? How can I impact others? And that's for me leadership, right? And not what position necessarily. And I think by living that up, then I think that's your very unique way of getting things done. And then you need to find an environment where exactly that capability helps you to become and, you know, get a leadership position and whatnot.
Any tips you have? You mentioned about the importance of self-awareness. Any tips that you have in how to go down that journey of self-awareness? What are the things which you have done personally to try to reach that high level of self-awareness?
Mm-hmm. I think one is self-awareness comes with self-reflection, to really reflect of what you did, why you do things, and how you did things. Reflect yourself, if you think that was the right way to do it, and be also self-critical, right? So self-appreciation of, yeah, this is really what I think, what I did well, but also being self-critical, or maybe I should have done that better. And this would be for me the first step, to kind of go into yourself and think about this. And then the second one is, once I've done my part of self-reflection, I normally try to talk to other people that I look up to, that I think have a very good set of experience, are very honest also. And then I ask them for feedback, right? Hey, this is a situation that I had, and my self-reflection showed me that this is what I did well, but here I was really unhappy with myself, and I think going forward I should do this. So having mentors that you trust, that you respect, and then having a regular exchange, and also being honest about maybe insecurities and getting help also to solve them. I think that that combination helps me at least to be very self-aware, and to not stop kind of questioning yourself and getting feedback from others.
Yeah, fully agree with everything you said. I think that's some really good practical advice for anyone who's listening. A question I like to ask my guests when they come on the podcast is, has there ever been a time where you have failed to get the stuff done that you needed to? How did you go about getting back on course, or how did that work out in the end?
Yeah, I mean, here I would like to be vulnerable and open. I think I am very good at getting things done when it comes to professional goals, career goals. I'm very focused and I get it done. But by having that strong focus, sometimes I don't get as many things done in my day-to-day, in my personal life. So there, for example, I sometimes miss to reply on time when it comes to my own, let's say, banking stuff or things like that. Or and that's always something why I've been wondering why that is, right? This is an area that I want to proactively work on, finding the balance on getting things done between sort of professional things, but then also on family related things, and then in my own personal related things that I need to take care of, like my personal health goals, sports goals, relationship goals. And I think here I can do a notch more, and I'm currently developing the strategy. I don't have that solution yet. I think I need to just do a better job in allocating the time and the focus. Mm-hmm. And that's like a mental thing to do. And also here again, working with the people that you spend most time with, to ask for feedback. And if they proactively give you feedback, to reflect on this again, it's like, oh, maybe you're right. I didn't do this getting thing done in the household that I was supposed to do. It looks minor, but it's equally important as the goals and things you should get done in your professional life. And so definitely a continuous improvement journey. I'm getting a lot of things done, as you have mentioned. Otherwise, I think I wouldn't be doing the things that I do in my job today. And also my personal life, I'm not doing that bad. But there, I think I self-reflect and see that there is some more areas I can improve. Okay. along the journey.
Maybe you also have a very, very high standard of expectation, perhaps, as well. I'm not sure about that. But the one thing that came up in my mind when you were talking there is from a famous speaker in the US, who talked about mm-hmm. the ability to outsource your personal business as well. I'm not talking about your mm-hmm. personal relationships, but the things which you need to get done in your personal life, anything yeah. which is not worth your time, outsource it. And initially yeah. you feel, why would I pay someone to come to my house to wash my car? Just a random example, when I can do it myself. But mm-hmm. you haven't washed your own car in the last 3 months because you've been too busy, or you haven't had time, you've prioritized other right. things. So the reality is
Correct.
that perceived cost of outsourcing it actually is a gain, because you're getting it done at the right time, the time in which you want to, and you are then able to use your time to do the things which are most effective for you. So that was quite an interesting food for thought that I came mm-hmm. across from him.
I think that's a good advice, and I think I have some things in mind that I could outsource actually moving forward. And this is a thought that I've had, and now I am actually in the phase of, you know, trying to organize those things. This I want to outsource, and just to have a little bit more quality time outside of work, right? Maximizing the time. And I think that's absolutely worth it. That's a great advice.
So I think we are pretty much coming to out of time now. I think we've been able to cover a wide range of subjects and topics. Mm-hmm. And thank you for being so candid with your responses, Sunmi. Real pleasure having you as a guest. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this super, super interesting and fun conversation. I really enjoyed the talk, and wish you as well all the best, Gordon.
Thanks so much to everybody who's been listening and watching this latest episode of the Get Stuff Done podcast. As always, let's get stuff done.
Thank you for listening to the Get Stuff Done podcast. If you would like to be a guest in the future, please do reach out. Or if you would like to recommend someone, that would be awesome as well. Make sure you keep listening, as we will be bringing you fresh insights every week, because getting stuff done is something everyone needs.